Okay, so this is the second in a series of three lectures on two-parameter bifurcation diagrams. And I'll do the last lecture next week, Thursday, in this room. And then that'll be the end of this course. Okay? So today I want to focus on Takens-Bogdanov bifurcation. But I'll start off by reviewing what we did a couple weeks ago before I went to England. And then we'll get into some new material. Okay, so first slide. So we're talking about two-parameter bifurcation diagrams. In other words, on the plane, we plot two parameters, P and Q, in differential equations, and we follow a loci of characteristic codimension one bifurcations with respect to these two chosen parameters. So the lines that I've drawn on this two-parameter bifurcation diagram, those are fold lines or saddle node bifurcation lines. So whenever you cross one or the other of these lines, you undergo a saddle node bifurcation. And inside the triangular-shaped region, you have three steady states, two stable steady states, and a saddle point. And as you cross the saddle node bifurcation line, you lose the saddle point and one of the stable steady states, and you're left with just the other stable steady state. And of course, if you start on the left and move through the bistable region and end up on the right, you'll first create a new steady state, and then you'll lose the old steady state. And so these two steady states, in some sense, are different from each other. And you see that difference when you move through the bistable region. Now, these loci of saddle node, these are saddle node bifurcations are codimension one bifurcations. That means, in general, you have to have the freedom to change one parameter in order to find the bifurcation point. So if I fix the parameter P and if I fix the parameter Q and vary the parameter P, then as P increases at a particular value of P, I cross the fold line, and that's where the bifurcation occurs. So that's said to be a codimension one bifurcation. Similarly, I could fix P and vary Q and also cross the line by varying one parameter, and I'll come to a critical bifurcation point in the parameter that I'm varying. Now, typically, when you follow these lines of saddle node bifurcations, they come together in this very characteristic cusp point. If you press the button. If we do a cut through the two-parameter bifurcation diagram, we'll see a typical one-parameter bifurcation diagram. We're plotting variable against the parameter, and you see the two saddle node bifurcations in the region of bistability. And this cusp point where the saddle node lines come together is a codimension two bifurcation point, because I have to have the freedom to vary two parameters. I have to vary both P and Q at the same time in order to find the cusp point. So that's a codimension two bifurcation point where two saddle nodes come together. And in a sense, all cusp points look the same. So here I've put a magnifying glass around the cusp point, and that's the typical behavior of the system in the neighborhood of a cusp point. And the terminology for this is it's sometimes called a universal unfolding. So the codimension two bifurcation point at the cusp has this characteristic set of behaviors in the neighborhood of the cusp point. And you always see this behavior, and you don't see anything else. It's a universal unfolding. All cusp points look the same in that respect. Okay? Now, the degenerate Hopf bifurcation is another example of a codimension two bifurcation point. So the degenerate Hopf is here. It's where a supercritical Hopf bifurcation changes to a subcritical Hopf bifurcation. And I need it's a codimension two bifurcation because I need to vary two parameters in order to find the degenerate Hopf bifurcation. And at the degenerate Hopf bifurcation, there's always a locus of cyclic fold bifurcations that comes in tangent to the locus of Hopf bifurcations, and they meet at a tangency, kind of like a cusp point, but it's different, okay? It's a different kind of codimension 2 bifurcation. And the behavior of the system in the neighborhood of the degenerate Hopf bifurcation is, again, always the same. As you cross a supercritical Hopf bifurcation, you go from a stable steady state to an unstable steady state surrounded by a stable limit cycle. As you cross a subcritical Hopf bifurcation, the unstable steady state becomes stable and you give birth to a small amplitude unstable limit cycle. And as you cross the cyclic fold bifurcation, the stable and the unstable limit cycles come together and annihilate each other, and you're left with the stable steady state. So you can do a circuit around the degenerate Hopf bifurcation and see how the pictures all fit together. Hit the button. Okay? If I do a one-parameter cut in the neighborhood of a degenerate Hopf bifurcation, then what I'll see is a stable steady state, and the first bifurcation I come to is the cyclic fold bifurcation, which creates the two limit cycles, the stable and unstable limit cycles, and then I increase P a little bit further and I cross a subcritical Hopf bifurcation where I lose the unstable limit cycle and now have an unstable steady state. And then if I increase the parameter P far enough, say here I'll go through a supercritical Hopf bifurcation. And that's where the stable limit cycles come from. Okay. So this is how you interpret a two-parameter bifurcation diagram, is by doing one-parameter cuts in different directions and figuring out what the one-parameter bifurcation diagrams are going to look like. And the two-parameter bifurcation diagram essentially tells you how these codimension 1 bifurcations have to fit together. And there's only a limited number of ways in which the codimension 1 bifurcations can fit together to give a consistent picture that's consistent with the vector field that underlies the dynamics of the system. Okay? So there's kind of two analogies that you can use here. One analogy is that these are like little Lego blocks, and these are the rules for how the Lego blocks fit together. Or you can think of it as a jigsaw puzzle, and this tells you how the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle have to fit together so that the photographs on the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle match across the boundaries, right? The codimension 1 bifurcations are the boundaries of the jigsaw puzzle, and the vector fields are the picture on the jigsaw puzzle. And this shows you how to put the pieces together so that the pictures match across the boundaries of the pieces. Okay, you with me? And now I've used the magnifying glass to zoom in on the degenerate Hopf bifurcation. And again, this is a universal unfolding. All degenerate Hopf bifurcations look like this. Okay? So it tells you how you change from a subcritical Hopf bifurcation to a supercritical Hopf bifurcation. Okay, this is all review of what we did 2 or 3 weeks ago, last time we met. Are there any questions about this? Okay, next. So this is the new material. Now I want to talk about the Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. And again, it's a codimension 2 bifurcation point. I need two parameters, and I have to have the freedom to vary both of the parameters in order to find the bifurcation point. And at the bifurcation point, several different loci of codimension 1 bifurcations come together at the codimension 2 bifurcation point. In the case of a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation, you're bifurcating essentially from a locus of saddle nodes. This is a locus of saddle node bifurcations, and coming off tangent to the saddle node bifurcation is a locus of Hopf bifurcations and a locus of saddle loop bifurcations. So all three loci come together tangentially at the codimension 2 Takens-Bogdanoff point. Okay? Now let's talk about what the underlying attractors and repellers are. So hit the button. Okay? This is a This is a locus of saddle node bifurcations. And on the right-hand side, we have a single stable steady state, a stable node. And as we decrease parameter P and cross the saddle node bifurcation, there's the creation of an additional stable node and a saddle point. Okay, so I go from a single stable steady state to three steady states, stable, saddle, stable. Okay, that's the classical kind of a saddle node bifurcation. But it's also possible when I cross a saddle node bifurcation to create an unstable steady state and a saddle point. That's a different flavor of a saddle node bifurcation. So just like at hop bifurcations, when the steady state loses stability, you can create either a stable limit cycle or an unstable limit cycle. At a saddle node bifurcation, you can create either a stable steady state plus a saddle, or you can create an unstable steady state plus a saddle. Okay, those are the two different flavors of saddle node bifurcations. And the switch from one flavor to the other happens at a codimension 2 bifurcation point, and there are other bifurcations that must occur simultaneously in order for the vector fields to fit together. And in particular, we're going to need a subcritical hop bifurcation and a saddle loop. So look what happens. As I go from a single stable steady state, cross this saddle node bifurcation in the counterclockwise direction, I get an unstable steady state and a saddle point. Then, when I cross the hop bifurcation, the unstable steady state changes to a stable steady state, and you throw off an unstable limit cycle, because this is a subcritical hop bifurcation. Okay? So I can change the stability of the steady state, but as I do that, I have to throw off an unstable limit cycle. But I can get rid of that unstable limit cycle at a saddle loop bifurcation. The unstable limit cycle grows in amplitude as we move from the hop bifurcation, and eventually it bumps into the saddle point, into a homoclinic orbit to the saddle point, and that destroys the unstable limit cycle as you go through the saddle loop bifurcation. And then you're left with this signature, SXS. So all the pieces fit together. And again, this is a universal unfolding. All Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcations look like this. Okay? Although I should tell you, they come in two flavors. This could be a supercritical hop bifurcation. You can basically change the stabilities, make this stable, and then go through a super hop critical hop bifurcation and get a stable limit cycle. That's just changing the swapping the stability of the steady state and the limit cycle. So Takens-Bogdanoff, like hop bifurcation, comes in two different flavors, subcritical and supercritical. Saddle nodes, Takens-Bogdanoff, they always come in two different flavors. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so these are the basic patterns, the basic rules by which codimension 1 bifurcations fit together when you have the ability to vary two parameters at once. Okay, let's see what's next. Ah, okay. So now I want to talk a little bit about some ancient experiments that were done back in the 1970s in France using what are called continuous flow stirred tank reactors. So the little diagram shows you a tank, and that tank has a chemical reaction mixture, an aqueous solution of chemicals that are reacting with each other. It's continuously stirred, okay, so it's got a little stirring bar in there to keep it stirred up and keep it homogeneous. And it's a continuous flow, so you're all the time flowing reactants into the reactor, letting them react, and then letting the excess flow out, the outflow valve, okay? So it's a continuous flow, stirred tank reactor. And that way, you can you can run a chemical reaction for very long periods of time because you're continuously replenishing the reactants and washing out reactants and products, everything that's in the reactor. Okay. So these people started using these reactors because they were interested in studying oscillating chemical reactions. And when you try to do an oscillating reaction in a batch reactor in just a beaker, it'll oscillate for a while, but then it'll run out of reactants and it'll stop. But if you do the same reaction in this continuous flow reactor, you can the oscillations will continue for as long as you feed it, okay? For days and days and days. It'll continue oscillating as long as you keep feeding it, okay? So you can think of it, it's kind of like the chemist's version of a living cell, okay? It eats and it defecates and it just maintains itself in some stable conditions for long periods of time, okay? Now, they were studying particularly inorganic reactions with autocatalysis, and they were looking for oscillations and bistability in these chemical reaction systems. And they have some parameters that they can vary, namely the concentrations of the basic reactants in the inflow stream, okay? So they might be feeding it with bromate ions and some other chemical, okay? Two chemicals, okay? And they can control the concentration of those two chemicals in the input stream, or maybe they're controlling the pH of the reactor. They can also, another parameter that they can control is the rate of inflow and outflow, okay? How fast you're flushing things through the reactor, okay? So there are lots of different parameters that are under experimental control. And they did many, many experiments varying these parameters and looking to see whether the system had a single stable steady state or two stable steady states that may be bistable or spontaneously oscillatory. And they mapped out the results of these experiments on a two-parameter bifurcation diagram, okay? So here are the two parameters, P and Q, that the experimentalists are varying, and you have to imagine what the figures look like in the original papers. There's a checkerboard of points scattered across this two-parameter bifurcation diagram, and the little points show you whether there's a single stable steady state or bistability or oscillations, okay? And what they concluded from lots of these sorts of experiments, when you did that, it didn't matter particularly which parameters you chose, what you found was what they called a cross-shaped phase diagram. And now, just say a word about the terminology here. Mathematicians call this a two-parameter bifurcation diagram. Chemists call these phase diagrams because they think the way they think of it is they're varying control variables, and they're seeing what the behavior of the system is, and for historical reasons, chemists called those phase diagrams, like solid, liquid, gas kind of a thing, okay? Single, stable, steady state, bistable oscillations, okay? So they call it a phase diagram, and they call it a cross-shaped phase diagram because in all of their experiments, it always turned out that you could find this kind of cross in the phase diagram with single stable steady states on opposite sides, and then a wedge of bistability that comes to a point, and on the far side of the point was a second wedge where they always found oscillatory solutions. Okay? It was kind of crazy. Nobody expected it, and it became a very fruitful way to find new chemical oscillators. You just had to find a system with autocatalysis that could be bistable, and then you map out the bistable region and see where it comes to a point, and then look on the other side of the point, and bingo, every time they looked, there was a new oscillator. Okay? And nobody really understood why this worked so well, why it was a cross-shaped phase diagram, and why it always seemed to predict where you could find a new oscillator. Okay, what's next? Okay. So, in 1986, there was a very lovely paper published by an applied mathematician named John Guggenheimer on a very simple nonlinear dynamical system. Okay, I call it a toy model, and it's just two differential equations. The equation, it's almost completely linear. There's only one nonlinear term, which is this minus x cubed term. That's the only nonlinearity in the system. And the thing that makes it interesting is maybe this 3x term, dx dt equal 3 times x. That's a kind of way of creating an autocatalytic process. Okay, when x is small, then x is going to increase in an exponential fashion. Dx dt equal 3 times x. That gives you the exponential explosion of the system when x is small. But then when x starts getting big, then the minus x cubed term eventually takes over and stops the exponential explosion. Okay? And then the y is a kind of recovery variable. So x takes off, and then x makes y, and y kills x and brings the system back again. Okay? So it's an autocatalytic system with negative feedback and a cubic nonlinearity, but otherwise very, very simple dynamical system. And Guggenheimer started looking at the two-parameter bifurcation diagram for this system, and he found a cross-shaped phase diagram. The two parameters are lambda and k, and there's a cusp-shaped region where the system is bistable. So the system is bistable in this region, bounded by two saddle node loci. And on the far side of the cusp is a region of oscillations, and that region of oscillations is bounded by two loci of subcritical Hopf bifurcations. And I haven't finished this diagram. The subcritical Hopf bifurcations are kind of coming down towards the cusp. And the question is, what happens when the subcritical Hopf bifurcations start interacting with the cusp? What happens when the nonlinear oscillator starts interacting with the bistable switch? Okay? And Guggenheimer was the first person to map out all the bifurcations that occur in this system. And it's actually quite surprising the complexity of the behavior of this very simple system in this region of the parameter space. So let's look at the next slide. Okay? This is a schematic diagram of the complete two-parameter bifurcation diagram for this simple system. The differential equations that Guggenheimer was studying has a lot of symmetry to it, okay, because it's so simple. It has a lot of symmetry to it, and you can see the symmetry in the two-parameter bifurcation diagram. There's a reflection symmetry through the horizontal line, okay? If you break the symmetry, it's easy to break the symmetry of the system. If you break the symmetry a little bit, you'll break this diagram, and it'll become even more complicated. It has a certain simplicity because of the symmetry, but still it's extremely complicated. But let me try to walk you through it and show you how the different pieces are fitting together in terms of the codimension two bifurcations that we've talked about so far. So first of all, you can find a locus of saddle node bifurcations that's coming up in this direction. That's a locus of saddle node bifurcations coming to a cusp. And then the other part, half of the cusp is this locus of saddle node bifurcation that runs off the top. Okay? So there's the codimension 1 bifurcations, the codimension 2 bifurcation. Here are the subcritical Hopf bifurcations. There's one below and one above. Those subcritical Hopf bifurcations cross the saddle node bifurcations. That's not a bifurcation point. And they come into the interior of the cusp. The subcritical Hopf bifurcations come into the interior of the cusp, and they cross each other, and they end at a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcations at the top and the bottom on the far left-hand side. There's a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. Okay, so that's the origin of the subcritical Hopf bifurcations. But as we know now, If it's a Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation, not only is there a saddle node and subcritical hop, but there's also a saddle loop that has to come out. And that saddle loop comes out of the Tokens-Bogdanov bifurcation. It goes across the region of bistability to the other side, and the locus of saddle loop bifurcations connects with the locus of saddle node bifurcations on the far side at a codimension 2 bifurcation called a saddle node loop, SNL. That's a codimension 2 bifurcation. Okay? And then between the two saddle node loops is a codimension 1 bifurcation called a SNC. It's not labeled here, but I haven't talked about this yet. Okay? This is a new bifurcation. I'm going to talk about it in the next slide. But it's a consequence of all the other bifurcations that are in this picture. It has to be there as well. Okay? There are degenerate hop bifurcations on the far right, and the degenerate hop bifurcations change the subcritical hop bifurcations into supercritical hop bifurcations. Okay? And then what happens, it doesn't show on this diagram, but the locus of supercritical hop bifurcation that comes out the bottom, loops around to the far right, and comes in the top. So there's a big bubble of mostly supercritical hop bifurcations. And inside that bubble, you have an unstable steady state surrounded by a stable limit cycle. Okay? So that's your region. Here's your region of bistability, and on the other side of the cusp is a region of stable oscillations that are coming from supercritical hop bifurcations. Okay? So it's almost like a needle that's blowing up a balloon. Okay? It's like you attach a balloon to the end of a needle and then inject air through it and you blow up this bubble on the far side. The bubble is where the oscillations are, and the needle is where the bistability is. Okay? So, codimension 2 bifurcations that we have seen, the cusp and the Tokens-Bogdanov and the degenerate hop, the codimension 2 bifurcation that we haven't seen yet are the saddle node loop bifurcations and the degenerate loop bifurcations. So I want to talk about them and describe those codimension 2 bifurcations in the next couple slides. You with me? You have questions at this point? You mean where is the cusp located? Yeah, the cusp is at lambda equals zero, k equals zero, and lambda equals zero. Both parameters, k and lambda, are zero at the cusp, I'm pretty sure. But you should look up Guggenheimer's paper for the details. Okay? And actually, a good exercise, after we walk through and learn a little bit about these bifurcations, go forward. A good exercise. A good exercise is to try to figure out what the vector field looks like in every one of these domains. Okay, and you should do it without looking at Guggenheimer's paper, and then you can go and look at Guggenheimer's paper for the answers. Okay, and he gives a nice. In fact, this is copied from Guggenheimer's paper, right? But I white it out. Every one of these areas is labeled with a letter, A through M or something like that. And then what goes with this is a tableau of 15 different vector fields, phase diagrams, that belong in each of these different positions. And it's a very good exercise to try to do that for yourself. Maybe we'll come back and do a little bit of it before the end of the hour if we have some time. Okay. Next slide. So let me try to describe a saddle node loop bifurcation. At a saddle node loop bifurcation, this is where a locus of saddle nodes comes together with a locus of saddle loops. Okay? And they come together at a tangency, And that's the codimension two bifurcation point, the saddle no loop, this is the saddle node loop bifurcation. Saddle node coming together with the saddle loop. And what does the situation look like in the different regions around this bifurcation? On one side of the saddle node, we have a single steady state. In this case, it's an unstable steady state with a stable limit cycle around it. When I cross the saddle node bifurcation, I create a saddle point and a stable steady state in addition to the unstable steady state and the stable limit cycle. When I cross the saddle loop bifurcation, the stable limit cycle gets killed by the homoclinic orbit from the saddle point. That's the saddle loop bifurcation. It kills the limit cycle. And now I have an unstable steady state, a saddle point, and a stable steady state in this region. But what happens if I go in the counterclockwise direction from here? Unstable steady state, stable limit cycle. As I come in this direction and I cross this bifurcation line, I lose the stable limit cycle at exactly the same place where I gain the stable steady state via a saddle node bifurcation. So the two things happen at the same time. That's called a SNC bifurcation, a saddle node on an invariant circle. At the bifurcation point, there's a trajectory, a homoclinic orbit that goes from the saddle node back to the saddle node. And that's where the exchange occurs, at the SNC bifurcation. Let me see if I have some. Yeah, let's look at the one-parameter bifurcation diagram. The one-parameter bifurcation diagram, as you pass through a SNC bifurcation, I'm plotting the variable as a function of the parameter. For small values of the parameter, I have an unstable steady state. Unstable steady state surrounded by a stable limit cycle. Okay, so there's the maximum and minimum of the stable limit cycle. As I approach the SNC bifurcation, I create a saddle point and a stable steady state at exactly the same place where I lose the stable limit cycle. Okay? I think we talked about these infinite period bifurcations a couple weeks ago. So you can think of this as either a way to destroy limit cycles or to give birth to limit cycles if you're going in the other direction. And remember, this is an infinite period bifurcation. The period of the limit cycle goes to infinity as you approach the bifurcation point. Okay? And the two-parameter bifurcation diagram shows you how these one-parameter bifurcations have to fit together. And again, this is a universal unfolding. All saddle node loop bifurcations look the same. Okay, let's look at the next. Now, in this diagram, I'm trying to show how all the different bifurcations might fit together in a single bifurcation diagram. So now I have saddle nodes that come together in a cusp and define a region where the system is bistable and outside the system is monostable. If I cross this saddle node bifurcation, I go from one stable steady state to two stable steady states separated by a saddle. That's the normal situation. But now if I keep going in a clockwise direction and I cross the SNC bifurcation, I lose the saddle and the node, and I create an unstable limit cycle at that SNC bifurcation around the stable steady state. But that's exactly, let me see. Yeah, then if I keep going in a counterclockwise direction and I cross this saddle node bifurcation, I now create a saddle point and a stable steady state in addition to this beast, and that's the diagram that occurs just in that little region. And that's the one, the classic, that's at the Tokman-Spogdanov bifurcation. Okay? And now I can get rid of this unstable limit cycle in two different ways. I can cross the saddle loop and get rid of it through a homoclinic bifurcation and get to this region, or I can cross the subcritical Hopf bifurcation and in the limit cycle will shrink down and change the stability of the steady state from S to U, and I go into this region. And from this region, I can go out I have a mistake, right? That should be a U rather than an S. If I go out one side, I destroy the unstable with the saddle point and left with a stable steady state. If I go out the other side, I'll destroy the stable steady state and get an unstable steady state. And then if I cross the subcritical Hopf bifurcation, the unstable steady state will go to stable and you'll get an unstable limit cycle. Okay? So this is pretty typical of drawing two-parameter bifurcation diagrams. It's easy to make mistakes, but just like a jigsaw puzzle, you have to look and see if the pieces fit together along the boundary, okay? And that's the way you find your mistakes. Okay, so I was in a little bit too much of a hurry. But that means, well, what does that mean? That means if this is a U and this is an S, well, you tell me, what's a necessary consequence? Well, okay, this U can't exist by itself, so maybe there's some other attractor somewhere. That's probably true, yeah? What else does it mean? What happens if I start here with an unstable steady state and now take a circuit where I increase Q above the cusp, increase P beyond the cusp, and then decrease Q. And I come into this zone, and the steady state is stable. Well, what has to have happened? If the steady state is going to change from unstable to stable, I must cross... I have to cross a Hopf bifurcation, right? There's got to be another locus of Hopf bifurcations that I haven't put on the diagram that'll change the stability of the steady state. So you can also tell whether your picture is complete or not. So this picture has at least two mistakes, and right? Because I made a mistake and this was an S, I didn't realize that there had to be another bifurcation. But this has to be a U. That was my first mistake. And my second mistake is then there's got to be another locus of Hopf bifurcation up in this region somewhere, because I have to cross it. If I take a loop in parameter space around the cusp, I'll have to cross a Hopf bifurcation. And I have to look for that bifurcation and I have to follow it. Okay, so this way of thinking is a tool for figuring out, for deducing what the behavior of your nonlinear dynamical system has to be. What bifurcations have to be there, and what bifurcations to look for, and how to find them, and how to follow them. Okay, it's an extremely powerful tool, and when you finally get a diagram where all the pieces fit together and all of the phase diagrams fit across the boundaries, then you know you're finished, right? That you got all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle and you fitted them together properly and the picture matches across all the boundaries, you know you're done. Does that make sense? Okay, There's one last codimension 2 bifurcation that I need to describe in this lecture, and that is called the neutral saddle loop. And a neutral saddle loop is very much like a degenerate hop bifurcation. In a degenerate hop bifurcation, this would be a locus of hop bifurcations and a cyclic fold that comes off, and you change the hop bifurcations from supercritical to subcritical, from giving you stable limit cycles to giving you unstable limit cycles. The neutral saddle is the same sort of a bifurcation, but for saddle loop, for saddle loops, okay? Because remember, a saddle loop can create a stable limit cycle, but it can also create an unstable limit cycle. Okay, so saddle loops come in two flavors. They create stable limit cycles or they create unstable limit cycles, and you have to be able to switch from one flavor to the other flavor, and that occurs at a neutral saddle loop bifurcation. Okay, so first, we'll look at the normal situation where I create a stable limit cycle. So let's look at this picture. This is everything here is occurring with inside a cusp where you have three stable steady states. Okay? Because a saddle loop, a locus of saddle loops can only occur inside a cusp where you have three steady states and one of them is a saddle. Okay? So here's my saddle point. And here's a stable attractor, and here's an unstable repeller. Okay? So an unstable focus, a stable focus, separated by a saddle point. And look at, concentrate on the trajectories or in the neighborhood of the saddle point. Okay? So from this unstable focus, there's a trajectory that comes out of this unstable focus and comes into the saddle point. Okay? And there's another trajectory that comes from far away and comes into the saddle point on the other side. And if I look at the trajectories that come out of the saddle point, one of them goes directly onto the stable focus. The other trajectory that comes out of the saddle point loops way around and winds down onto the stable focus from the other side. Okay? So that's a perfectly valid, qualitatively robust vector field. It just has a single global attractor. No matter where you start in the state space, you'll eventually end up on that stable attractor. Okay? Now, what happens as I cross a saddle loop bifurcation? So hit the button. As I cross the saddle loop bifurcation, I have to make the homoclinic connection from the saddle back to the saddle, okay? So the trajectory to follow is the one that comes out of the saddle to the left. It loops around, and instead of winding into the stable steady state, it comes back to the saddle point along the stable manifold. So that's a homoclinic orbit. And that's structurally unstable. That's a codimension 1 bifurcation point. And as I change the parameter a little bit further, I break the homoclinic trajectory, and now I break it to this side. On the upper side of the bifurcation, this trajectory breaks to the inside and winds down onto the stable steady state. At the bifurcation point, it's a homoclinic trajectory that comes back to the saddle point, and then as you go past the bifurcation, this trajectory loops around and misses on the other side and winds out to the stable limit cycle. Okay? So that's the classic situation at a saddle loop bifurcation to create a large amplitude stable limit cycle. Okay? Okay, now push the button. what happens when I cross this locus? I create an unstable limit cycle inside the stable limit cycle. Okay? And then, now I have a single stable steady state, an unstable limit cycle, and a stable limit cycle. Of course, I can kill those two limit cycles by going through a cyclic fold. At the cyclic fold, the stable and unstable limit cycles will come together and annihilate each other. And I'll get back to this picture. It's the same picture. But what's happening at this bifurcation point? At this bifurcation point, now, again, we're following this trajectory, the trajectory that comes out of the saddle point to the left, and it loops around, and it misses on this side, and it winds out to the stable limit cycle, right? But now as I change the parameters, this trajectory can come back and become homoclinic again, okay? And instead of missing to the left, it now comes right in on the stable manifold into the saddle. Okay, so that's the homoclinic. It's exactly the same as the one over there. But now we're going in the opposite direction. And when I cross the bifurcation point, then this trajectory is no longer homoclinic, but winds into the stable limit cycle. But as it does so, it has to throw off a limit cycle. But in this case, the limit cycle that it throws off is an unstable limit cycle, because it's undergone the bifurcation in the reverse direction. And I think I did this right, but you should check me and make sure all of my arrows fit together right, because the vector fields have to be consistent. But this is the nature of the events that occurs in the vicinity of a neutral saddle loop bifurcation. Now, in Guggenheimer's paper, he uses slightly different notation than I'm using. And also, it's a little harder because of the symmetry of the equation. He gets a codimension 2 bifurcation, which is not generic. If we go back to his diagram, this one. This is not a generic codimension 2 bifurcation point. This is a highly degenerate bifurcation point because of the symmetry of the system. And that's another exercise for you. If you break the symmetry of the differential equations a little bit, you'll break that and you'll get the standard bifurcations that I talked about. And you can do all of this with XPP. Okay, it's trivial. It'll take you 5 minutes to type the ODE file and start drawing phase planes and drawing bifurcation diagrams. And just you can put almost any arbitrary algebraic function into the differential equations to break the symmetry with a little epsilon in front of it, and that'll slightly break the symmetry of this bifurcation diagram and give you back the standard robust codimension 2 bifurcations. Okay, I think that's it. Was there anything past here? No. Okay. So I'll quit here. If anybody wants to sit down with me, we can try drawing little portraits of what occurs in the different regions of Guggenheimer's bifurcation diagram for practice. And we'll meet next week at this place, at this time, and I'll talk about the last codimension 2 bifurcation. It's the most complicated codimension 2 bifurcation. And it's one that I've never seen. So if you've had enough, you can skip it. But for completeness, you should know that it exists, because who knows, we might see it tomorrow. It's just as robust and natural as any of the other codimension 2 bifurcations we've talked about. It's just that I've never seen it in any model that we've worked with. But I'm sure it's out there somewhere. And once I do that for you next week, you'll have the whole zoo of codimension 1 and codimension 2 bifurcations to build signal response curves from. Okay, that's it.